This is Lionel Corbett, 9 November 1997, A Depth Psychological Approach to the Divine.
With spatial boundaries, and it gets very contaminated with human fathers and mothers and kings and judges that we know about. So there's a depth psychological approach to this problem, which is to think about the divine in terms of a transpersonal level of the psyche. There are human levels of the psyche and transpersonal levels of the psyche. And I want to talk about how this idea works in practice. There are a few startling postulates that come out of this kind of work. The first one is that, perhaps we should open the door in case anybody wants to bolt at this point, but the first one is that the God of Western monotheism is actually an idol. The second one is that a question that Jung raised, which was, is God a neurosis? And the answer is, it can be. And then there's a comment of Meister Eckhart where he says, God save me from God. A very, very important remark that I'd like to talk about. But all in all, the main value of the depth psychological approach to thinking about the divine in terms of the transpersonal psyche is that for many people, the Judeo-Christian tradition is not working very well. It doesn't seem to correspond to the structure of the personalities that we see nowadays. It doesn't seem to address what is really sacred to us. So people have to find out, in that case, what is really sacred to them in their own way. Now, if you are happily contained in the Judeo-Christian tradition, in other words, if all your anxieties and concerns are answered and addressed by the Judeo-Christian tradition, actually you could leave at this point because there won't be much in this for you. But there are many people who have a spirituality which is not fully addressed by the Judeo-Christian tradition. And then what happens to those of us who are in that position is that our spirituality has to become very personal, very individual, and it develops very often inside us like a kind of secret inner life that we very often don't talk about with many other people. And it's a very big sacrifice to give up the tradition of our childhood. It's because if we have a yearning for the sacred, if we know that there is something larger out there, if we give up the tradition of our childhood, we may not know how we can then contact the sacred. We may not know what the vehicle or the channel of connection really is. So, and this causes a lot of pain because it's like something that you love that you can't connect with. So the problem arises for people for whom the Judeo-Christian mythology is not working. How then can I find this connection? How can we live a spiritual life or religious life without commitment to pre-existing theological or doctrinal ideas about how the divine should manifest itself? Because the fact is that for many of us, the divine manifests itself in ways that are not traditional. I'll give you an example of that. I have a friend who has been a Catholic priest in a religious order for 30 years, and he's been somewhat happy in the church, but not fully. And he's never been clear why he's not been fully happy, why he's not been fully contained. It was as if there was always something that wasn't being addressed, and he could never put his finger on what it was. Recently, he had a dream in which a huge goddess figure appears above him, and he's holding a chalice, the kind that they would use to serve mass with, to serve wine with at the mass. And this huge goddess figure starts to secrete milk out of her breast, and the milk pours out of her breast into the chalice that he's holding. Now, and then he said to me, I finally realized what had been missing for 30 years, because clearly this is a man for whom a kind of male father sky god and all that masculine imagery doesn't work very well. And clearly what is sacramental to him is the milk of the goddess or the food of the goddess. So that dimension is mediated to him in a feminine form, not in terms of all the masculine metaphors that he's been used to. So he was having to practice a kind of spirituality which was not in tune with the real structure of his personality. And I think most of us have deep structures like that, which we have a kind of spiritual typology. And if the Judeo-Christian tradition doesn't address our real spiritual typology, then it fails for us. And the difficulty is that they give you that tradition gives you a set of images and doctrines that tell you what form the divine should take. And then, but if you happen to have a concept of the sacred or the holy that doesn't fit with what the tradition tells you, the forms that it should take, then you can be completely lost because it's appearing to you in another way and you're not realizing what it is. Another friend of mine who's been deeply committed to a Christian church for a long time phoned me some time ago, very distressed, and said he had a dream in which a voice said to him, God dooms us to live a life apart from him. That was a dream voice. And dream voices carry a lot of authority. And he said, what on earth does this mean? This is so important to me, and so on. And I reminded him of Meister Eckhart's comment, God save me from God. Because the dream and the comment mean the same thing. That what they mean is, if you have a preconceived idea about God and about the way the divine should manifest itself, then when you get it in some other form, this concept of how it should be will completely prevent you realizing what's happened, the way it's actually manifesting in your life. So hence, God save me from God, meaning that don't let some concept of God get in the way of my direct experience. Let me have it the way it comes, not according to how I think it ought to come. So the depth psychological approach takes the position that an experience of the sacred or the holy does not have to take a Judeo-Christian form. That may take a Judeo-Christian form. We're not in the business of demonizing the old gods. If for you it takes a Judeo-Christian form, then you might well be authentically Christian or Jewish or whatever. But there are many people for whom it doesn't. what are they left with? Well, for those people, what we're interested in is a particular quality of an experience, first of all. And the quality is the quality of numinosity. I'm not sure if everyone's familiar with that word. The word numen, N-U-M-E-N, comes from a Latin word meaning a god, a divinity. And the Latin verb nuere, N-U-E-R-E, means to nod or to beckon. So this word numinous that was coined by Rudolf Otto in 1917, and it was appropriated by Jung in the 30s in his Terry lectures on the psychology of religion. And the word means a kind of divine beckoning or divine approval, the nod from God, that's the sense of the word. All kinds of experiences can be numinous, or we could say the numinosum, which is the noun, can appear to us in all kinds of different ways. So what we look for psychologically is not the content. It doesn't have to be a vision of Jesus or Mary or something like that. It may be, of course. It's not that those experiences are not valid, but it may take an entirely different form. The important thing is the quality. And Otto, to describe this, used the phrase mysterium tremendum et fascinans, meaning a mystery which is at the same time tremendous and fascinating. So when you have one of these experiences, it's an experience of awe, of A-W-E, of dread, of fascination, often of something other, with a capital O, something that you experience which you know is not of this realm. It doesn't have to have that quality of otherness. Many mystical experiences are actually experiences of unity. So we have to expand. Well, we have a sense that the world flows into me, I flow into the world, and there's, for that moment, no separation. Those experiences are very numinous as well. So we're expanding a little bit on what Otto originally said. Basically, this is the idea. It fills the mind with wonder. It's astonishing, it's fascinating, often very terrifying. And it's not the same as ordinary fear. It's not the same as when you nearly have a car accident. It fills the mind with a kind of dread. It's an uncanny kind of quality to it. But it's not a... not a matter of intensity, it's more, because it can be just the still small voice. It's more a matter of the quality. An example that I report in my book is an example that happened to me of a gigantic UFO which appears in a dream and descends down, very, very enormous, like the size of an apartment building, descends down and hovers a short distance over my head. That was pretty awesome and frightening in its own right because I wasn't sure it was going to stop. But it hovers there, and I'm covered with this, and then lights start to appear and shine down on me. And when I look up at the lights, they're very bright. They're coming out of eyes on the base of this UFO. The light is coming out of the eyes, and the eyes shine down on me. Now, that was a very numinous experience for me in the dream, because clearly the UFO symbolically has to do with otherness. With the sense of the dream is something is coming from another realm, not of this earth. Those of you who know Jung's essay on flying saucers will know more about this. For him, these were images or symbols of the transpersonal self, something wholly other in this case, something that otherness that comes from beyond the ego. And hey, by the way, you don't, of course, take the question of UFOs existing literally or not is irrelevant here. This is about the reality of the psyche. It's about things being real if they have a real effect on you. It's not about whether they are real in the sense that they exist in the way that physics and chemistry can show them to exist. But they are part of a living myth that's going on nowadays. Now, of course, there have always been reports of intervention from the beyond in difficult times, and in our era, this is one of the ways that that intervention is occurring. But the mandala shape, the symmetry of the UFO, usually there's square or circle or some combination of squares and circle, according to Jung, produces the sense of wholeness, the sense of order, the sense of symmetry, and the sense that even though your life might feel chaotic, there is a center, there is meaning, there is order in the process. And typically, these kind of experiences occur during times of stress. Mandala imagery and numinous imagery occur during times of stress, partly because the ego is sufficiently weakened or thinned that the veil between the realms seems to thin at that time. Now, traditionally you could say that I'm seen by the eye of God. That would be a more traditional theological way of saying it. Psychologically, you could say that I'm seen by the self. Now, this dream makes an important point, which is that one of the ways that the numinosum can manifest itself is by addressing itself to a neurotic area inside the personality. See, this is, first of all, what I meant when I said that the numinosum can manifest itself in a way which is not in the Judeo-Christian form. The Judeo-Christian tradition doesn't recognize UFOs as manifestations of the divine. But if they meet, if any experience, whatever it is, this dream or some other dream, meets the criteria of being numinous, according to that list that I mentioned to you, the allure, the fascination, the mystery, and so on, the fear, then it qualifies. It doesn't matter what the content is. And the point is that there is no room here for a normative theology. There's no way of saying that this experience of the numinosum is more important than that experience of the numinosum. The psychological idea here is that if it meets this criterion of being numinous, then it's a transpersonal experience. It doesn't matter what form it takes. This straight away frees you up, you see, to experience the numinosum in your own way. That's the whole point here. The neurotic piece was that when I was growing up, I had parents who didn't see very well who I was. I always grew up feeling kind of not seen. So here I have this huge thing, like as big as a house, seeing me. You know, like the self is saying, "How much seen do you need? Is this enough seen for you? Will you quit worrying about being seen?" You see, that was it's a compensatory and so on. But the point is, it addresses a neurotic difficulty. And this is what Jung meant when he says that the real healing comes from contact with the numinosum. Very often, numinous experiences are very healing experiences. Not always. They can also make you crazy. But if they don't make you crazy, they will often help you because they come into an area of emotional difficulty for you. Another example of that would be a woman that I worked with who was dying of metastatic cancer. And was having a very hard time, both with me and with the people trying to take care of her, because she had trouble accepting help. She had trouble letting herself be helped. And the difficulty was that she'd grown up in a family where she'd had to be the mother of lots of younger siblings. No one took care of her, a very familiar story. So that she grew up with a very brittle sense, there's no one can help me. I have to do it all myself, you see. And not only that, it's all up to me. There is nothing else, because she never had the experience of anything being, anybody or anything being there for her, and she never felt a part of anything. She always felt totally alone, totally burdened by having to do everything herself. So when she got very ill, she again felt very alone and that she had to do everything herself and so on. So the dream that she had was, and she had massive death anxiety, because she was frightened of being alone. And death had to do with being alone and so on. The dream that she had was a dream of being outside at night, a very dark night, pitch black sky, and when she looks up, she sees millions of stars in the sky. And they're all not just white twinkling as we normally see them, but all different colors, and millions of them. A sky full of all different colored stars. And she said, I looked up, and suddenly, she said, I realized that I was a part of all of that. And that was an enormously healing experience. It was the first time, it was very, very numinous. It was the first time that she'd ever felt a part of anything, and that there was something out there that she could depend on, a kind of a ground that was not, it wasn't all up to her anymore. Now again, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the stars are not one of the manifestations of the divine, but in terms of the quality of experience, it had that effect. This was another example of healing contact with the numinosum. Just for the sake of the therapists here, I know there are a few. This is the kind of experience that you do not need to amplify if the individual gets it. You know, you don't need to interfere. I mean, this dream could have been amplified with the Egyptian mythology that after we die, the soul becomes a star. Or, I could have said, oh, well, the star represents the realm of spirit, or spirit coming through the darkness, destiny written in the beyond. You know, all kinds of things flashed into my mind about what to say, but I managed to restrain myself because it wasn't necessary. You see, she got it. So there was no need for me to say much, except to affirm the validity of the experience for her, which is really all she needed. Was it really that? Yes, it really was that. That was enough. Because people want to know if they can take these things seriously. They say, well, if it's just a dream, surely it's just psychological, and that means it's somehow not real. But the whole basis of this and Jung's thinking in this area is that the psyche is real. These are not just concepts. These are living entities that visit when we have these kind of dreams. And they are very, very real. They have profound healing effects on us. That's what's meant by the reality of the psyche, which academic psychologists never seem to understand. Are there any academic psychologists? So the function of a therapist or a helper in this kind of situation is only really is important when a person has an experience like this and doesn't get it. Sometimes people have very numinous events happen to them, and they say, well, this happened, but they kind of look puzzled and they don't understand what it's about. Then it's as if one has to try to open the meaning of the experience for the person, release the sacrality of the experience by pointing out what it was. Otherwise, there's no need to say much. But this is the psyche-centered approach. It says that there's a personal level of the psyche and there's a transpersonal level of the psyche. The transpersonal level, of course, is the objective or the autonomous psyche. And that when we dream or when we have a vision and so on, we experience that level relatively directly. Then, of course, the question always arises, well, how do you know whether the psyche itself, can you tell whether the psyche itself is generating these experiences? Do they begin in the psyche, or do they come from a transcendent divinity that's beyond the psyche? It's a fair enough question. It always upsets the theologians. The theologians hated, and the psychologists all hated this notion of Jung. The theologians didn't like it because they didn't like the idea that something in the psyche could be divine, because they thought that was idolatry. That was Victor White. Then they thought it was... Martin Buber said that Jung was doing a kind of psychologism, reducing something which was really beyond the psyche to something nothing but psychological. And the academic psychoanalysts like Frome didn't like it because they felt that he was elevating the unconscious to a religious phenomenon. So there were attacks on this idea from all sides. I just don't want you to think this is a kind of a straightforward idea. It's not. There are some objections to it. There's a lot of literature on this, but the answer to the objection is that, well, you know, there may well be, first of all, there may well be a transcendent level of divinity, a godhead, beyond the psyche. That's entirely possible. It's also entirely irrelevant, because the only thing that matters to human beings is what we can experience. What we're talking about is not transcendent levels of divinity, which are, if anything, belong to metaphysics or theology. They're speculative. What matters is immanence. What matters is what we can directly experience. Once you can directly experience something, actually it's psychology. You're not doing theology anymore. You're doing psychology, because by definition, psychology is about what can be experienced. What else is the psyche? The psyche is the organ of experience. Without the psyche, we wouldn't be able to experience anything. So once you're experiencing something, you're in the psyche, and then it's legitimately an aspect of psychology. So I'm not concerned with this question about whether there's something beyond that, beyond the psyche, that's kind of coming through it. That's possible, but it's unknowable, because for me to have any experience, the psyche has to be present. So I can't seem to get out of that, so I'm prepared to stay in it and just say that I'm only concerned with experience. I'm not concerned with what might be beyond experience. But this whole notion of beyond and in and so on might be the residual kind of Cartesian way of thinking. It may be that the dream, the psyche, is a part of nature, that we're a part of nature, and that there really is no difference between me and the dream and the psyche, and that the only level at which these things are boundaried and feel different is in the level of the ego, and that we shouldn't be so egocentric as to imagine that that's the only perspective. It may be that there really is no barrier. Anyway, the point is that these are living experiences, and Jung, when we talk about these experiences as being numinous, we're not reducing them, because we're not saying, a reduction would be to say it's nothing but a brain mechanism. You were fatigued, you were tired, you drank too much coffee, you hadn't drunk enough coffee, you hadn't had enough sleep, or you had a little epileptic discharge, it's a defense mechanism. You were frightened, you were alone, and so you had to come up with something that made you feel better. I mean, there are all kinds of ways in which one could reduce these experiences. This example was just an experience of, the eyes would be the residue of an infantile experience when I was lying in my crib as a child and my father loomed over the crib, right? That would be a kind of a psychoanalytic reductive explanation. But there's no need to do that. We can take these experiences at face value and say they are what they are, and our criterion for that is simply the numinosity of the experience. And we aren't saying where they come from. Psychology just is about experience. Now, the other axiom here is, of course, that these processes, this numinous experience, is mediated by the transpersonal psyche, but there are, as it were, pattern-forming processes in the deep psyche that Jung calls archetypes. I guess everyone here is familiar with that notion. Is there anybody who's not familiar with the notion? Good. So the archetype simply just means natural law. Just as physicists have the laws of thermodynamics, the law of gravity, the psyche, which is also a part of nature, has its own laws, and these are what we call archetypes. It just means that the psyche is not random. It works according to particular patterns. So there are these deep structures, deep processes in the psyche, and the idea is that these are the origins of these numinous experiences, and that's why Jung calls them organs of God. Organs of God in the psyche. So the archetypes, of course, correspond very roughly to the gods and goddesses of earlier times. But they're not only a source in this model, they're not only a source of religious experience. The archetypes are very important in forming the structure of the personality. So that, for example, you have a mother archetype, the divine mother, the goddess, or the feminine aspects of the divine, roughly synonymous terms, or the father archetype and so on. And your parents, when you're a child, mediate that transpersonal level for you. In other words, they humanize what is essentially a transpersonal experience. See, Freud got it the wrong way around. Freud thought that God was a projection of the father onto the sky. But actually, it's the other way around. Actually, your father or your mother mediates the divine for you. And the problem, of course, is that they can either mediate it in a nice way or an unpleasant way. And so this theory says that the archetype is ambivalent. You can experience it positively or you can experience it negatively. If you have the right kind of mother, let's say, I don't mean to be mother bashing, if you have the right kind of mother, you have a positive mother complex, but if you have the wrong kind, you have a negative mother complex. But in either case, you have this archetypal strand at the center of your complex. So you have a transpersonal lineament a transpersonal pattern former, say the mother archetype, surrounded by all this personal material forming the shell around the core of the complex. So it's like the warp and the woof of a fabric. Your neuroses have a transpersonal element and personal elements, and they're inextricably mixed. It's in a way a mistake to say that the transpersonal level is deeper, because it's not deeper. It's just you couldn't have one without the other. You couldn't have any kind of complex at all. It's really more of a warp and woof. It's a mistake to think of the objective psyche as deeper, because it doesn't just go down. It extends laterally into the world. It's like the air that we breathe. We're in it all the time. Just like we're breathing air, psyche is moving through us. So we are kind of like television sets that transmit the divine mind, if you like. That would be a somewhat crude metaphor. It so happens, the problem is, that's why the transpersonal, in this way of thinking, transpersonal psyche is so intimately bound up with personal material, so that the personal and the transpersonal are seamlessly linked, so that when you work on your personal material, your personal neurotic difficulties, your complexes, you are actually struggling with an element of the divine. That's why Jung asked the question, is God a neurosis? Because these transpersonal elements can make us very neurotic. And very often when you get down to the core of some complexes, you see this. For example, an example of that. A woman had a very difficult mother complex, and she dreamt that she's on a small boat like a canoe, and she's going down a very dark river at night. And ahead of her in the water, she sees there's a bright patch of bright light on the water. And when she gets to this patch of bright light, she sees this gigantic female figure, like as big as a huge building, standing astride with one foot on either side of the riverbanks. And the light seems to be emanating out of her body. Pardon me. And she has many breasts, like the Diana at Ephesus figure. But a lot of breasts and gigantic. Now this is clearly the divine feminine, or the mother goddess. This is not a human figure, but you can see what archetype it belongs to very clearly. Now what happens in the dream is that she goes into the light, and as she gets under the legs of the figure, she cannot stay awake. She falls asleep, goes unconscious, falls off the canoe and drowns. Okay? Clearly depicting the fact that this woman's mother was so enormously powerful that around her, in her aura, in her light, this woman, especially as a child, simply would drown, would go unconscious. She couldn't maintain her own sense of her own self. You see the metaphor of the dream. So that's an example of that archetype in its negative form, you see. So a man dreams that he's chained to some steps, and at the top of the steps there's this Kali-like figure who periodically takes a bite out of his neck and sucks some of his blood. And blood trickles down the steps, and he's in servitude to her. Okay. Now, that's a negative mother complex. This is the divine feminine in her negative aspect. Remember, she can have positive or negative. Now, but the point is, in this way of thinking, if you've got that kind of mother complex, needless to say, this man didn't do well with women. His relationships were extremely problematic. But if you've got that kind of mother, if you've got that kind of mother complex, you're not going to go to a church or a synagogue and experience the divine as some sky god with a long white beard sitting on a mountain volcano in Mount Sinai. That's not going to do it for you. You see, you have to experience the divine in your own way. If you are enthralled to the goddess, that's where you have to be. Okay, a woman grew up in a home where everything feminine was devalued. She dreamt that there's a kind of witch's cauldron in front of her, and there are broomsticks with witch heads going around this cauldron, and she's got this big ladle kind of thing, and the voices, the witches are going around and saying to her, stir the pot, stir the pot. Okay. Now, this is a woman whose great interest was in the ways of the wise woman, not the witch in her negative aspect, but the positive aspect. to try to deal with this devaluation of the feminine principle in her home, she'd become very interested in midwifery and healing, and those arts traditionally of the wise woman, okay? And that's what the dream is encouraging her to do, you see. But again, some male sky god or some patriarchal male images of God would leave her completely cold. This is the point of this method. The point is, you've got to get it in your own way, okay? And if your own psychological structures are different than the tradition that you grew up in, they won't work for you. You'll go into a church or a temple and nothing will happen. And Jung said, once the gods have left a temple, they never return. Well, they never return because it's all gone cold. It's like once it was molten lava coming out of a volcano, but now it's just totally stone cold. It's not there for you anymore. A woman came to see me with a problem with sexuality and the body and so on. She'd grown up in a very orthodox, rigid Catholic home where the body and sexuality were thought to be sinful and bad. She wasn't allowed to shine her shoes because they reflect upwards. It was that kind of situation. Well, to cut a long story short, the dream that she had was that she's in church receiving communion, and the wafer, instead of being an ordinary wafer, is full of raisins. Okay. So, and of course, she associated to raisins Dionysius, the god of wine. Now, the women followers of Dionysius, the Maenads, were not shy about the body. They liked sex, they liked the body. And Dionysius was a god who tried to free women from the constraints of the patriarchy. He was that kind of god. That's why he had a lot of women followers. And he was into ecstasy, and he wasn't into this kind of sexual austerity, just the opposite, Dionysian frenzies and so on. So the dream is saying to her, this archetype is sacramental for you. Not what they're telling you, the Dionysian level of the body and sexuality and ecstasy is sacramental. So there you have a very good example of how the teaching of the tradition that she grew up in was completely in opposition to what the psyche is saying is sacramental to her. Do you see the point? That's the point about this method. Again, if you have an experience of the divine in the Judeo-Christian form, you see, that I think makes you, authentically puts you in that tradition. So again, I'm not trying to say that there's something wrong with that. I'm trying to say that that doesn't fit with everyone's psychological structure. That the Judeo-Christian mythology actually irritates a lot of people. I'm speaking personally. It irritates me because, for example, just to be at the beginning, in the book of Genesis, where Adam and Eve are forbidden, I think I've forgotten where I am in my notes, but anyway, they're forbidden to eat from the tree of knowledge. Do you remember that? On pain of death and whatnot. Rather, on pain of expulsion and so on. Well, I used to find, when I read this as a child, I was outraged by this. This used to irritate the hell out of me, and I could never understand why. Now I understand why, because for me, knowledge is worship. That's one of my forms of understanding, of relating to the divine, is through study and teaching and learning and so on. So to be told that I can't do it because some character in somebody else's book tells me I can't do it, I find offensive. That's the kind of thing that I mean when I say that the mythology may not correspond to the structure of the individual personality. Okay, let me just try and catch up with myself. The point I wanted to make was about the archetypes, which, just to bring myself back, was that in any given personality, although all the archetypes are present in some way, They are configured differently. They're in a different relationship to each other. So that, for example, some people will have more Aphrodite energy, some people will have more Zeus, some people will have more Hera, and so on. And because of the fact that they're configured differently, different people will find different things numinous. So your experience of the numinosa might leave me cold, and vice versa. That's the point. The point is not that simply that we share the same archetypal structures, that they're all in a different relationship to each other. Like, look at the astrological birth chart. Take Mars and Venus. These planets in the birth chart are archetypal forces in the psyche. Remember Dr. As Above, So Below. It's the Mars out there is the same as the Mars in here. So you can have Venus, Aphrodite and Mars in a friendly relationship to each other or in an oppositional relationship to each other in different people. And then your relationship between the masculine and the feminine in your own psyche, or between aggression and love and so on, would be configured differently. That's the point. So you have to figure out how do the archetypes manifest themselves through me in this way of thinking, and not think that you can go to a text and find it in a text. See, in the sacred texts like the Bible, the problem with the sacred texts is that they're all stories. That the divine is talked about in a story form. Now, the problem with stories is that you have heroes and heroines and protagonists. You can't help personifying your heroes or your protagonists as having a particular character structure. You behave in a story, the characters behave in a particular way. Okay? So here you have God behaving like this in this story, and here you have God behaving like that in that story. You have all these personalities. It's a multiple personality. And then you have other Bibles, the Quran or some other sacred text, where you have another set of stories. Well, whose set of stories is correct? I mean, this psychological method wants to get rid of this notion that the divine has some kind of personality and a set of rules that we all have to follow, because the rules are going to be different for everybody. That's the bad news. You have to figure out how. There's a joke about that, which is that Moses came down from Mount Sinai and said to the people at the foot of the mountain, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is that I've got him down to 10. The bad news is that adultery is still in. But the point is, you can't do it like that anymore, because there might be different rules for you than there are for me. I mean, there are some common sense things that we would all agree about. But in terms of how we should live our lives, what individuation would look like in a given person might be very different. So, in other words, you're not going to get it. If this way of thinking is right, this is what Edinger calls the new dispensation. In the sense of the word is the dispensing of the divine grace into the world. If he's right, in this way of thinking, revelation is going to be individual and personal, and it's not going to come through one or two people in a way where the same rules are supposed to apply to everybody. Which makes it harder, but also easier. Now some people have said to me, well, it's not that these traditional ideas don't work. I think it was G.K. Chesterton who said, the trouble is not that Christianity doesn't work, it's that it hasn't been tried. It may have been C.S. Lewis, I can't remember. One of those types said it. Was it C.S. Lewis? Thank you. But the point is, that I don't think that's fair, because, you know, what if you went to the FDA and you said, you know, for 2,000 years we've been trying this medicine for spiritual yearning, and we find that it works some of the time, but a lot of people it doesn't work for. The FDA would say, well, 2,000 years is a fair trial. How long do you need? I mean, I don't think it's fair to say it hasn't been tried. And then if you ask yourself, and the tradition itself, of course, goes back further than that, if you ask yourself, why hasn't it worked? It often doesn't work because people pay lip service to it, and they pay lip service to it because it really doesn't resonate with them. Because the idea that you can only relate to the divine, let's say, through Jesus' sacrifice for us, doesn't ring true for everybody. Some people feel you can relate to the divine in other ways, other than that. It doesn't always entail a bloody sacrifice. Now, it might. It's not that it cannot. But there may be other ways that you can get there. And you know that somebody is an authentic Christian because of their behavior, you see. They don't need to be told how to behave, because authentically, that radically, their behavior changes. You don't find this situation like Northern Ireland, where you've got two branches of the same tradition killing each other, arguing about who's right. And clearly, those people who are doing the killing are not authentic Christians. Authentic Christians wouldn't do that. They're people, same with Nazi Germany, which was ostensibly a Christian nation. The real Christians were in big trouble at that time, but there weren't all that many of them. There were only a few of them, and they're the ones that behaved decently. It's the same thing you see in the Middle East with two monotheistic traditions fighting each other and killing each other, ignoring their own sacred texts, which tell them not to behave like that. Because they've just paid lip service to it. The teachings don't resonate with who they are. These are people for whom the real God is a God of war and violence. Did you have a question? That reminds me of that. That reminds me of somebody who asked Joe Campbell whether he was an atheist. Do you know this story? And he said scornfully, "Madam, how can somebody who believes in so many gods be an atheist?" This is the problem of the one and the many in the monotheistic versus the polytheistic notion of the psyche, which is kind of an interesting argument in psychology. The polytheistic position is that there are many centers of interest in the psyche, that any one of which can grab you, and there may not be one underlying unity, as a kind of monotheistic approach might suggest. And I don't know the answer to that. There may be an underlying unity. I personally feel that there probably is, just based on what I've read about modern physics, that there seems to be an underlying unity to things. But what I would say is that you get the experience of the divine that you need for that moment, for where you are at the moment. That's what's given to you. And if you try to go somewhere else, you may be missing the thing that's right in front of you. So I can't really answer the question in a direct way. I would just take the position that you should, I would take a kind of obstetric position. You just deal with what's coming out at the moment. Okay, if it's the head, look at the head, don't worry about grabbing an ankle. I mean, I think you've just got to deal with what's in front of you, how it happens to you. And you've got to have, there's still room for faith here. The faith that I have is that I will get the experience that I need, and that in that experience, everything will be present. The difficulty is that what I mustn't do is freeze that experience. See, if I was a fundamentalist, I would say that the UFO, and I would say, that's an image of the divine, and I would put that on my altar, and that would be that. And I would freeze it and say, that's it for all times. But this method says, no, these things are just temporary. A year down the road, or 5 years down the road, you may have an entirely different experience of the numinosum, because you need it coming at you in a different way. So I can't answer that question directly, except to say that you just deal with the experience as it is right now. I don't know if that's satisfying to you or not. But, yes. Yes. Oh, societally. Oh. Yeah. Well, yes, I think it would. But I wouldn't call this approach pantheism, because it's not that we think that the tree or the bird is God or something like that. You know. It might be called panentheism. You know that, is that Mueller's phrase? Or? I forget who coined, or was it? No, it's earlier, it's an old phrase. Panentheism, I forget who to attribute it to, but the idea is that the divine is in everything. Which is a little different than saying it is the tree or the bird, but you could say it's in there. If you have an experience, like I just heard of a woman who's out in the garden, and she's there's a bird in a tree, and she's just sitting under the tree. All of a sudden, the tree lights up with a kind of inner light, and there's a radiance all around the tree and the bird, okay? And she's full of the sense of the presence of the holy and the sacred. Now, she for years wouldn't talk about this experience because she was afraid that people would think that she was a pagan and that she meant she was worshipping the tree. That would be more of a pantheistic, or the bird, you know. But it's not that. It's that she experiences the sacred in it, or through it, or via that, you know, by means of that. So, yeah, that's right. Moses at the burning bush would be an example of a numinous experience. He saw a bush that was burning and it wasn't consumed by the fire, and a voice said, come over here, and so on. So the divine is in it, yeah, but it may not. I can't answer the question of whether it is that. Maybe it is that. Maybe it's everything. But that's getting out of psychology. That's getting more into realms of philosophical speculation. How much time do I need? Oh, gosh. I was going to just talk about another... Shall I stop? Another very important... Let me just give you one more, because it is 8:30. I promised I'd stop after an hour, and then... have questions afterwards. Another very important way that this numinous experience can manifest itself is through synchronistic events.